Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. We're speaking today with Mark Oppenheimer. He's a religious historian, an avid public intellectual, writes for Harper's, The Wall Street Journal, The Boston Globe, Slate. He's the editor of the New Haven Advocate and the author of two books about American religion, Knocking on Heaven's Door, American Religion and Counterculture in the Nixon Years, and 13 in a Day, The Bar and Bat Mitzvah Across America.
Happy to be here.
Do you mind if I ask right up front, because I was fascinated that you're on the editorial board also of Christian Century.
Used to be.
Mm-hmm. But I take it that you're Jewish.
Right.
And so you have a obviously sufficient breadth and depth as a religious scholar to have been of interest to Christian historians as well.
Well, my graduate training was mostly in the history of the mainline Protestant denominations. So I, at the time anyway, I was much more qualified to write about the traditions that the Christian Century writes about, the Congregationalist Church, the Unitarians, the Episcopalians, those kinds of Protestant traditions, than about really anything else. I mean, that was my original scholarly interest. I got my start in college. My first interest was in the Unitarians. I had a very close friend growing up whose father was a Unitarian minister, and so I knew I had been to more Unitarian services by the age of 18 than those of any other church, including Judaism.
I was delighted, actually, to see that in Knocking on Heaven's Door, American Religion and Counterculture in the Nixon Years, you focus on five different denominations, Unitarians, Catholics, Jews, Baptists, and Episcopalians, and the different ways that the counterculture had infiltrated them. And I guess for most people, it would be no surprise that gays are welcomed and embraced within Unitarian Universalism. I grew up in Unitarian Universalism, but it is a story in and of itself because, for instance, the church that I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, the minister came out around 1975, I think, and was actually had to resign as a consequence because there was not sufficient welcoming at that point.
That would have been very early, even within Unitarianism, for a minister to come out. And the first Unitarians to come out were by and large not ministers who had pulpits. They were. There was a minister who came out, but he was not affiliated with any church at the time. And then the Unitarians who followed him in coming out as gay in the early 70s were not by and large preachers. So yes, I mean there was still an expectation that the person heading the church, the leader of the flock, was straight and really until the 80s was a straight male, although women were ordained. So it was not. It would not really be until the 90s that most Unitarian churches would be comfortable with a openly gay preacher. One Unitarian minister whom I write about in my book was in the 80s and 90s sort of out to people who knew, but it was not anything that he ever talked about. And that was, I think, a pretty common situation for a lot of preachers, even within this most liberal of denominations.
Well, you'll be happy, I presume, to know that our little Unitarian congregation up here in Stores had a pagan, transgendered, lesbian witch as our
well,
minister.
Well, I'm happy for them. I mean, it's not my tradition. And one of the interesting things about writing about all of these other traditions is that there tends to be, I think, a lot of the people who read my book, the reviews were very, very interesting because people tended to assume that I endorsed everything that I was writing about. And the critique from the right, from conservative publications like First Things, which is edited by a very conservative Catholic, the critique from the right tended to be that I was obviously endorsing counterculture, that I was eager for the most liberal elements in Protestant churches to take over, to breach the barricades. And then there was a similar critique from the left, which was that I wasn't sufficiently enthusiastic. And the truth is that, while I wish Unitarians and Episcopalians and so forth well, my own spiritual path is not bound up with theirs in any way, and I don't lose a lot of sleep over what happens to people in those traditions, except insofar as they're fellow humans and fellow citizens, and I wish them well. But but personally, I'm much more emotionally concerned with the question of Jewish continuity.
Well, just to stay with the Christians for a second, and that is not to stay with the Unitarians, in other words. The Catholic issues that you write about, the introduction of the post-Vatican II reforms and the introduction of the folk mass, that seems to be something that's back on the table with Cardinal Ratzinger, or with Pope Benedict, as another one, because there's this new wave of neo-Orthodoxy, even more so than John Paul was pushing for.
Right. I mean, you know, there always seems to be some neo-Orthodoxy. Of course, you know, Karl Barth was seen as neo-Orthodox, 75 years ago. Of course, that was within Protestantism. But, you know, the Catholic Church is going through this endless cycle of progress and then retrenchment. And, you know, Ratzinger is definitely a conservative, and definitely the things that he chooses to focus on, the issues that are closest to his heart, tend to have to do with doctrinal purity. He, of course, was head of the Vatican arm that was most concerned with doctrinal purity. The
Inquisition.
Exactly. And they don't call it that anymore. But yeah, it was the successor body to the Inquisition. And so he was not someone who had, for a very long time, had a flock. He was not someone who had been in a pastoral position. So yes, Catholics are very, very concerned. And the document of November 19th concerning gay men in seminaries and the conditions for how far from a gay past they have to be before they're considered fit for priestly formation, obviously has people very, very worried that there is a witch hunt to come. Now, Catholics who've been around long enough will always remind us that the reach of the Vatican, you know, looms larger in theory than in practice, that it's the local priests and bishops who actually run things. And, you know, we all know that there are a lot of Catholics who have for years, even under the fairly conservative John Paul II, have received knowing winks and nods from their priests when they go to ask about family planning or birth control, that kind of thing. And of course, that will continue. You know, I mean, there aren't too many Catholic families of 12 kids anymore. So there's a lot that's unspoken in the Catholic Church.
Well, that's actually a story that we get hear a lot about. The story I think that's the most unheard in your book is about the Baptists and the anti-Vietnam War movement. And that's increasingly a buried history because the Baptists took this hard right turn in the late 90s and a lot of their seminaries got taken over by the Christian right. And so I don't imagine that there's going to be very much anti-war stuff coming out of the Baptists anymore. But tell us a little bit about that story.
Right. Well, the grand takeover wasn't until 1984 when the Southern Baptist Convention was finally in the hands of a very conservative president, and the president appoints the boards of all the seminaries. So there then was a real purge of liberals and moderates from the Southern Baptist seminaries. This was a denomination that as late as the 1970s, the early 70s, was passing resolutions in favor of a woman's right to choose an abortion in some cases. And that was against war, and that was very much in touch with its strong pacifist tradition. If you looked at the resolutions coming out of the Southern Baptist Convention in 1970, for example, you would think that you were dealing with a fairly liberal to left body. Now, there were elements of that, and the Baptists had historically been very uninterested in dealings with government. They were fairly separatist and had strong pacifist traditions in their ranks. And what I write about in my book is a kind of saving remnant of serious pacifism within the Southern Baptist Convention, of people who took seriously the Baptist tradition's teachings in the priesthood of the believer, and that you had to follow your conscience with matters pertaining to war, and they didn't want to fight. And these were kids. I focus on a group of students in North Carolina at schools like Duke and Chapel Hill and Wake Forest, which is a Baptist school. Students who who were not really radicals. They were the children often of preachers, but they were part of that strain, a strain that Jimmy Carter comes out of, incidentally, that was very focused on pacifism. Now, that was, by the time of the Vietnam War, a minority strain in the Southern Baptist Convention. And it was a minority strain that produced many of the people who went to the annual convention and voted on resolutions that were pro-choice and in favor of prisoners' rights, for example. What happened in the 80s when the right took over was, to be fair, something of a corrective that brought the official positions of the church in line with what most Southern Baptists by that point were feeling politically and religiously.
Well, in a sense, that's a critique that I can make as a, you know, an advocate of both democracy and secularism, of a lot of progressives' approach to religion in the United States, in the sense that for a long time, there actually has been an over-influence of secularism through media and intellectual institutions, and an under-representation of the religious orthodoxy that, that has been there at the grassroots. You know, 70% of the United States is religiously orthodox, if you look at their biblical beliefs one way or the other. So, you know, in some sense, like it or hate it, you know, the rise of the Christian right is, in fact, the empowerment of the grassroots of religious belief in the United States.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the Harvard philosopher, the political philosopher Michael Sandel says that fundamentalists rush in where liberals fear to tread. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that, that where it is at liberals and secularists' peril that they pretend just because they don't meet fundamentalists in the faculty club, that there aren't millions and millions of them out there. And not just fundamentalists in the strictest sense, but people whose lives are informed by religious faith. And American public culture was startled in the 1970s by the rise of Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority. They didn't know that these people existed. But, of course, millions of them existed throughout the country and not just in the South, and had since the early 20th century, when fundamentalism came into being as a kind of coherent theological movement. There were tens of thousands of churches that were religiously orthodox that most liberals knew nothing about, because the fundamentalist preachers were not going to the same seminaries, they were not coming to conferences at Harvard Divinity School, and a lot of times they were politically separatist. A lot of times they said, the world is evil, let's not vote. So when Falwell really broke from that in the 70s and said, let's marshal ourselves into a potent political force, let's help elect Ronald Reagan, liberals and secularists were completely startled, totally, totally taken aback.
Well, in my sphere of bioethics, the same things happened. The Christian right's been funding an enormous network now of Christian right bioethics institutions, and the liberal secular bioethicists are all astonished. Where did all these people come from all of a sudden? And, you know, they've actually been out there for quite a while. I'm speaking with Mark Oppenheimer. He's a religious historian and the editor of the New Haven Advocate, author of Knocking on Heaven's Door and 13 in a Day, The Bar and Bat Mitzvah Across America. I'm Dr. J, and this is Change Surfer Radio. Let's talk about 13 in a Day for a bit.
Sure.
The bar mitzvah, you argue, is traditional and has many deep roots in Judaism. The bat mitzvah is a creation of Reform Judaism. Am I correct?
Almost. The bat mitzvah is a creation of a particular strain of conservative Judaism called Reconstructionism, which now is seen as a separate denomination. But in 1922, Mordecai Kaplan, who was a very prominent conservative rabbi within his own congregation, he was a rabbi on the Upper West Side of New York, and in his own writings, he introduced what he called Reconstructionism, which has all sorts of specifics that I won't get into, but one of the tenets of it was gender equity, and or what for the time passed as gender equity. And for his daughter, he devised a ceremony called the bat mitzvah, the daughter of the commandment, as contrasted with the bar mitzvah, the son of the commandment. And yes, on a Friday night in 1922, she read some Hebrew scripture aloud at her congregation, which in the United States at the time was unheard of for a woman.
So has the bat mitzvah played a big role in the gender equity within Judaism?
Oh, yeah, without question. So in conservative Judaism, it was slow to take off. There weren't a lot of these ceremonies in the 1920s, 30s, or 40s. But in the 50s and 60s, it became a ritual within conservative Judaism and then adopted by what we think of as the more liberal Reform Judaism. And by the 1980s, the vast, vast majority of all Jews, except within Orthodoxy, would be having rituals for their sons and for their daughters. So what now? The ritual involves studying Hebrew and learning how to chant a bit of Hebrew scripture. So what you had created was a new generation of religiously somewhat literate women, whereas 100 years ago, all of the learning would have been left to the men. Now, one caveat to that is that within Orthodox Judaism, women might not technically be getting the same training, but the families are often so much more religiously literate. There's so much more Hebrew and Yiddish being spoken or read within the family that what a 12-year-old girl might just pick up from being around her father or brothers or mother will often be much more than even a quote-unquote religiously trained Reform Jewish boy gets. So the gender question is a tricky one because there are a lot of very, very brilliant Orthodox Jewish women who haven't had formal training.
I was trained as a sociologist, and actually my dissertation advisor as an undergraduate was an anthropologist. Mm-hmm. So I had a strong influence of the notion that rituals of transition were very important psychologically and culturally, and that one of the problems that we have, that men have in general in Western society, is that we have had this decline of rituals of manhood and of adulthood, and that so kids do dysfunctional things like have children at 15 as a ritual of adulthood. Are you part of the school of thought that we should be celebrating and encouraging these kinds of rituals, not just for religious purposes, but as psychoculturally?
You know, that seems right to me, that psychoculturally there is an important function to ritual in general. I mean, one of the strong claims that I make for religion is that while we might talk a lot about it being theistic, about it being about philosophy or theology or belief in God, and it is all of those things, it also simply provides routine ways for us to practice ritual. I like to say that, you know, there was a time in America when, if nothing else, you came together for a barn raising periodically when your neighbor needed help building a building. We don't have that anymore. Labor is so specialized and our lives are so compartmentalized that there are fewer and fewer reasons just to come face to face with other people. And religion does give us rituals where we do that. In terms of the young boy's passage to manhood or the young girl's to womanhood, I think that the Bar and Bat Mitzvah or the Catholic confirmation, for example, is a good ritual, but I think we do need to caution ourselves that if we're not doing the other things right as parents, then the ritual is pretty insignificant. So if fathers aren't spending a lot of time with their sons and raising them to be ethical and moral, if their primary relationship to their sons is buying them things or raising them to be wealthy, if it's going shopping for an SUV with them, then all the Hebrew school in the world won't give their children values, you know, that I might approve of.
Am I not correct that in Orthodox Judaism there actually is a ritual recognition of menses? When a woman becomes,
To my mind, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's right, but I'm not the expert.
Well, I defer to your expertise over my own.
You know, there is a folk custom that one hears about in Judaism, although no one in my family's done it, but there is a folk custom of slapping the young girl when she comes to her mother and says that she's first gotten her period. And of, you know, not a vicious slap, but a kind of, you know, a little potch on the face, as they would say in Yiddish. And I'm not sure where that comes from. And in fact, no one may know for sure. I do know one or two girls who say, oh, yeah, my mother did that because she said her mother did it to her. And it may have something to do with warding off evil spirits or who knows. But it may also be almost non-existent in this day and age. There is no liturgical, there's no synagogue-based recognition of that.
I know some pagans who do that, actually. Maybe I'm confusing paganism with Orthodoxy, which would be a huge mistake on my part.
I wouldn't doubt that a lot of pagans do that. I mean, and there's fascinating writings about the ways in which paganism has become thought of as a woman-centered theology. A lot of those writings based on kind of fallacious histories that some pseudo-scholars have constructed about a feminist prehistory. There's a lot of kind of questionable scholarship out there that you may know more about than I, about in the days before written history, the world was run by women and things like that, and none of it really holds up, but the pagan movements have adopted that pretty enthusiastically.
I'm speaking with Mark Oppenheimer. He's a religious historian. He writes for Harper's, The Wall Street Journal, The Boston Globe, and Slate, and he's the editor of the New Haven Advocate. Another of the essays that popped up in quite a few places when I Googled you was Typing Alone.
God bless Google, by the way, right?
Yes, right, exactly.
Now we'll never have privacy again. We'll be both more famous than ever, but less private.
I take my laptop into public talks now, and everyone looks at me like I'm a geek. But, you know, when someone gets up to speak and you have one line of their bio in the conference materials, and then you can Google them and find the 25 other things that are interesting about them,
right.
It's so much more educative. Anyway. Typing alone, you argue that on the basis of your experience both as a student and as a teacher at many different institutions, you argue that the value of individual scholarship and studying alone has been lost, and that students' lives are filled up with gen ed requirements and student activities and athletics and other things, and that we need to get away from those things in order to return to a traditional scholarship.
Yeah, that was That was an essay that really allowed me to bring together a lot of thoughts that I had had just about the ways in which we're so promiscuously busy with so many different things that there seems to be less and less time for focusing on one thing. I know that when I was in college, and we're talking 10 years ago here, there was a real culture of diversifying, of being well-rounded. And, you know, on the one hand, that sounds incredibly admirable, right? This is an old classical ideal of the sound mind and the sound body. We should be reading. We should also be playing sports. We should also be socializing. On the other hand, there are certainly human achievements that that we're going to be mounting fewer and fewer of because we don't take the time to master any one thing in particular depth. And I mentioned in that essay a writer who taught himself to be a good, one of the ways he taught himself to be a good writer was to sit down with the novels of Evelyn Waugh, the English writer, and to just type them, as if by retyping these novels he would get a feel for how Waugh had created that language. And what was so interesting was he had done that when he was an undergraduate at Oxford or Cambridge. This man had embarked on this Waugh project. And I thought to myself, that's really funny, because who at Yale or the University of Connecticut or wherever today would carve out the time to type something that wasn't even part of his coursework? I mean, it was so clearly from another era, even though this had happened in the 1950s or 60s in England.
I really related to that essay because, although you published it at the National Review, I have to point out, which to my shock and horror.
I have to defend myself there. I didn't publish it in the National Review. It was posted on their website. I've never published anything for the National Review. It was posted on their website after I'd written it for an odd little quarterly, an odd little journal called In Character, which is published by the Templeton Foundation, which is an odd philanthropy that tries to publish things that are at the intersection of religion and reason, or science and religion. So somehow I ended up writing about, you know, how we don't have enough time alone for a journal that is supposedly about religion and science. And the link was picked up by the right-wing nut jobs at National Review.
I'm much relieved to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, let me clarify the nut jobs. So there are things that appear in National Review that I find terrifically engaging, and some wonderful people have written for it. But by and large, you know, certainly, especially given its history of what I take to be sort of rapidly anti-intellectual support for creationism and McCarthyism in its time, I wouldn't be high on their list of freelancers.
Well, I related to the essay because when I was an undergraduate at Oberlin College, I took an enormous amount of time in my freshman year to write a long monograph that wasn't related to academic work on Buddhism and socialism, which I was trying to reconcile at the time. And then,
did you succeed? Did you reconcile?
Well, I regurgitated a lot of Buddhist Marxist scholarship that was coming out of Asia, but it's not something I'm proud of today. And then when I was a senior, something I'm a little bit more proud of, I wrote an enormous monograph, which was actually my senior thesis, on Pentecostalism and the evolution of Pentecostalism, which again relied a little bit too heavily on Marxist ideas, but still, I thought it was a good piece of work. But I don't see very many students encouraged, as you said, to do that kind of scholarship today. They don't have the same orientation to the life of the mind as a singular passion, and it's much more careerist.
Well, or if they do have it, it requires a level of sacrifice that, you know, for example, if you were to focus your undergraduate academic career solely on pursuing the roots of Pentecostalism, and you were to forego community service and political work and the drama club and all those other things, you would not be a strong candidate for any of the important fellowships to England for the Marshall or the Rhodes. You would perhaps hurt yourself, even in getting into law school or places like that. There's such a strong cultural demand now for people who have more than one thing that they're good at. And, you know, one has to ask, well, why? I mean, my understanding is that right now there's an undergraduate at Yale who is one of the world's leading scholars of Elvish, which is Tolkien's language, I think, that he created for the Lord of the Rings characters. And there's a whole lexicon to it and a whole, you know, a whole syntax and everything. And this young woman apparently knows more Elvish than anyone, you know, anyone alive. And, you know, I'm delighted that that got her into Yale. I presume that she was not also, you know, captain of her high school soccer team. Maybe she was, but you should be able to make your way in life as an impressive figure solely on your command of Elvish.
In my other life, my day job is as an applied sociological researcher in higher education in the role we call institutional research. And one of the things that's been developing in the field of institutional research is a growing recognition that the SAT is a very imperfect and in some ways extremely misleading measure of who should be in college. And what you say resonates with what is an increasing finding, which is that any kind of intellectual engagement, whether it's academic or political or artistic, that a student has a singular passion for, is a general predictor of their general success in college. And so it's not simply, you know, having gone to the right prep schools and taken the Kaplan. It's whether they actually have that kind of passion. And in fact, that passion could lead them away from having taken the Kaplan prep, you know, courses. And they might not do as well in the SAT scores.
In general, what we're talking about here, I think, I like to call connoisseurship, which is something that society does value in some rare places. You know, we like to think of ourselves as film buffs or as wine connoisseurs or things like that. But for some reason, we don't encourage in young people the idea that becoming achieving a deep, deep mastery of a particular area, even an esoteric one, is a real skill and is ennobling and enriching in a way that will spill over into other areas of our lives. Susanna Heschel, who's the daughter of Abraham Joshua Heschel, the great Jewish theologian, says that people ask, what was Abraham Joshua Heschel like as a father? And she says, well, what do you think he was like? He was absolutely wonderful. I mean, the kind of man who spends his days studying Talmud and other Jewish texts and trying to reconcile modernity with God is wonderfully equipped to be a good dad. And I don't think that's intuitive to people, but of course, you know, it should be, that the kind of sensitivity and discernment that is practiced in being a connoisseur of one thing often makes you a deeply humane person.
That's probably a whole nother conversation, because I've known quite a few scholars who I don't think were that great of parents. But I will have you back, Mark, to talk about that.
Sure.
I've been speaking with Mark Oppenheimer. He's the author of Knocking on Heaven's Door and 13 in a Day about the Bar and Bat Mitzvah in America. He's the editor of the New Haven Advocate, which can be found online and is a wonderful part of the alternative press in the United States. And I really appreciate your coming online with me today.
Absolutely. Anytime.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.